Now to this segment, the numbers tell the story. Economic inequality in this country is dramatic. We've heard of the 1% controlling a huge percentage of the nation's wealth, and of those at the other end of the economic spectrum finding it more and more difficult to manage their lives. We heard some evidence of that disparity in this first segment today. A new book, explores this inequality and its impact. It's titled The Great Forgetting: The Past, Present, and Future of Social Democracy and the Welfare State, written by Fontbonne University history professor Jack Luskow. Professor Luskow joins me in studio. Professor, nice to have you here. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
What is the Great Forgetting?
The Great Forgetting is a reminder of what we used to be able to do in hard times. It's also a reminder of what some people are able to do today in times of stress. Basically, the Great Forgetting is that we once knew how to deal, or at least we were able to cope with the period of the Great Depression. That doesn't mean that it was an easy fix, but the programs that were followed by Roosevelt were at least an attempt to overcome one of the great, really one of the great catastrophes of history, which probably could have been prevented. By the way, that also followed another period of great inequality. And there are many economists today who say that, in fact, inequality itself can cause recession and depression. So in many ways, we've really repeated what happened before. But what we haven't repeated really are the kind of programs, the kind of suggestions, answers that Roosevelt was able to bring about. Roosevelt, of course, struggled with that as well, but he at least understood that the main role of government is to get people back to work. He understood that the main role of government is to really employ social transfers to help people when they were really down through no fault of their own, and he had some success doing that.
He had a little help, however. He had World War II and, more specifically, the post-war period, which was a boom time for this economy.
He did.
We're not in that position.
No, and we don't want a war.
No, we just had a couple of them.
Yes. That's true. Roosevelt's programs actually did help the economy recover somewhat until about 1937. And then 1937, there was a bit of a lapse again. And I think that, and Paul Krugman has said as much also, that had Roosevelt simply spent more on the programs that he had already put together, had he spent more, put more people back to work and put more money in the pockets of people, that we could very well have come out of depression without needing a war or without having to boost spending because of the war. So there really is evidence to show that social programs could have resolved the depression much sooner. Had Roosevelt simply employed what he was already doing, but more of it.
Well, where are we now in terms of dealing with the kinds of problems that this country faces? We just talked for the past half hour about the role of poverty in our society and the high cost of it. What is the cost of this inequality in our society today?
Well, the cost of inequality is that too many people are suffering from all sorts of illnesses that they would otherwise not be suffering from. The source of it, there are many sources of inequality, of course, but we could do better, for example, if we restructured our health care system. Not everybody thinks that that's the cause of our inequality, but it is one of the causes, certainly. I'm not saying that that the Health Care Act, popularly known as the Obamacare, is a failure. I think it's the best thing that we've had in terms of health care. But it is also a source of inequality. And what I mean by that is that a huge amount of money is spent in order to maintain what amounts to subsidies for private health care for-profit insurance companies. Some 7 years ago, several Harvard researchers found in a study that in order to maintain and to keep private for healthcare insurers was costing the country something like $350 billion. Today, I'm sure it's more. I was just looking at some statistics on that. We spend, United States spends more as a share of its GDP, gross domestic product, some 18.1% of the projections for this year, than any other developed country in the world. If you look at Germany, which has a very sophisticated healthcare system, and which is not dependent on for-profit healthcare insurers, Germany spends about 11% of the GDP. It delivers much more for that, by the way. So essentially, their healthcare costs about 60% of what ours does per capita, but at the same time, it covers many things that ours does not cover. So normally, as we all know, health insurers will cover medical, but quite often they don't cover dental or they don't cover vision. If you look at the German system, it covers just about everything all in one package.
But let's stay with that for a moment. The critics of Obamacare, for instance, will say on the one hand that there is enough government already that we don't need government to controlling our lives. And others would point to the example you use as socialism. And there is no political appetite for that today.
Absolutely right. What is strange about all this is that the countries which have the best health care systems in the world, by the way, France, is regarded as number one by the World Health Organization. They're not exactly socialist countries. For France, although it has a socialist president, it's a capitalist country. Germany does not have a socialist president, Angela Merkel. She's not even a social democrat, as a matter of fact. She's a Christian democrat. Mm-hmm. So these are very capitalist countries. Sweden, another country which has a remarkable healthcare system, also. Obviously a capitalist country.
Well, when the British government took over healthcare in Britain, it was called socialized medicine.
It was, and it still is. People in this country will tell me how terrible it is because of government intrusion. In fact, that system is there because of the government. And what people forget is that the government does not do everything badly. It does not do everything wrong. If you really want help today, are you going to go to companies that have failed? Are you going to go to Wall Street, which practically destroyed the world economy? I don't understand why people distrust government so much in this country.
Well, it certainly is the subject of the political discussion today. I mean, the idea of more government seems to be kind of stuck in the mud at the current time in political terms.
Yes, and I think that's largely because in this country particularly, big money has big say in who controls government. So it's not the state. Let me just use that word instead of government. It's not the state that's the villain. It's whoever controls the state. And that's why we really need to talk in terms of democratizing our country, and not only democratizing our politics, but democratizing the way we work. Europe takes a lot of criticism because of government intrusion. In fact, the government's very much involved not in trying to hold companies back, but in entering into partnerships with them. And it's worked really well in terms of technological development. That says a lot, I think, what government can do.
When you talk about big money, let me ask you to be specific. I have my definition of what big money is. What's yours?
Big money for me is clearly Wall Street. Finance is really taking over, you might say, the whole country in ways that I believe it should not. If you look at the administration, several administrations back, what you'll see is the person at Treasury is always somebody who comes from Wall Street. That's not a surprise. But at the same time, the people who should be regulating Wall Street are the very same ones who just came out of Wall Street. So they're very unlikely to regulate it. In 1999, when we had a Democratic president in office, Bill Clinton, that's when we signed off and we allowed the big commercial banks to merge with the, just the regular deposit banks. I mean investment banks to merge with the commercial banks. And what that did was it gave an open window at Treasury for these very large investment banks to simply go up and borrow money from the very same taxpayers that they would soon register so much contempt for. I worked for Wall Street myself, not in New York, but I did work for one of the big investment companies. I have great admiration for a lot of these people, but we really do need to regulate them. We do need to put a firewall between investment banks and just regular commercial banks.
But, of course, the people who would regulate them are those who are being funded by them to run for office and make the regulations.
We need a new political narrative. I mean, that's so obvious. And people are very unhappy with both major parties now. And what I do not see is that either major party is addressing many of these issues. I think President Obama certainly had very good intentions. But at the same time, he brought in many of the same people from Wall Street. They were very resistant to change, quite obviously.
How did we get to the point? We keep using the term the 1%, and you know, I think everybody is familiar that that's where all the money is. How did we get to the point where so few control so much?
Well, go back to the way we do healthcare. When we simply allow very few companies to dominate here, when we pay allegiance, you might say, to the for-profit motive, even in healthcare, that's a transference of a huge amount of money right over to the corporations involved in ensuring our healthcare. And then, of course, let's not forget Big Pharma. When they can just go to Congress and they can routinely extend patents 25 years or more, because those kinds of things have to be approved. They get all sorts of subsidies from government also to do their research. That's one way. That's a huge transfer from us to them. So when you just look at one corporation after the other being able to sort of go up to the public till, that's one way in which that happens.
Is it realistic to think that that can change, or that we can change it, or that politicians will change it?
It's perhaps not realistic, but you know what? If we don't change it, we're going to have a lot more people going to the streets, and it won't just be racial incidents. There'll be a lot of social turmoil. Yes, we have had some of that. Occupy Wall Street. We've certainly had all sorts of demonstrations. Many of them in Europe, also some of them here in our country as well. You know, when you get to a point when 1% of the population controls almost half of the wealth of a country, and you get to a point where wages have been stagnant for 30 years, when the unemployment rate is actually much higher than the official unemployment rate, and some people are saying 17-18%, we can't congratulate ourselves on that at all, and we should have more people talking about it.
And it's 50% and more in many communities in this country today, which is a critical problem, needless to say.
Oh, it is. And the problem is that there's too much money and too few hands, and there's too little willingness of the same people who have it to put it back into the communities. They're willing to lend it back to us, but they're not willing to to invest it in us. So, you know, for example, there's $32 trillion that's being held in private. I'm talking about companies, firms in this country, because they don't want to invest it into our infrastructure. They don't want to invest it into our communities because they don't see the return there. It's because they're too used to putting money into derivatives.
Very short-sighted, isn't it?
Well, unfortunately it is, and that's why we're in the predicament that we're in.
While we're on this part of the discussion, let's bring in Mike calling from St. Louis. I think he wants to make a point at this juncture. Mike, go ahead, and thanks for waiting.
Hi, Don, and hi, Professor. I forgot your name, but I...
Lesko, is that pronounced correctly?
Professor. Yes, Lesko.
The core issue we haven't figured out yet, we found all the problems. But we haven't gone back to the core of the problem, which is essentially the breakdown of our economic freedom. And that goes back to 1913 when we established the Federal Reserve, which in my mind, my thesis is that the banks basically were more interested in creating this Federal Reserve to protect their interests. And they did so over time, but they transferred the risk, the market risk, down the scale. And we've reached the point now where there's no way to advance economically if you're not of the right structure. And that's a breakdown of our freedom, because we can't decide how to save, or what things to earn our money in when a group of 12 individuals decide to raise or lower interest rates to manage the big business economy. So it's not capitalism that is broken down. It is the structure that we've imposed on capitalism, which is an artificial construct.
Thanks very much for your call, Mike. Do you want to respond to that, Professor?
Yeah, I'm not here to obviously to advocate for socialism or communism or any of that at all. But I agree that we have capitalism, and that's the way we have to do it. It's the kind of capitalism that we practice, and we practice a sort of, I'll just call it extreme capitalism at this point. We've unleashed capital, which, of course, is globalized now, so that capital can really get beyond the reach of government in ways that it couldn't before. At the same time, labor is not able to do that because labor doesn't have the same mobility. So we're stuck with that particular problem, which we have to resolve, though I'm not saying globalization is the problem, however.
Yeah. You mentioned labor. I mean, what exists of organized labor today is just a small fraction of what it was 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, 7% organized now in the private sector in unions. We have quite a few right-to-work states now, which means that you don't have to join a union, even if the union has been voted in to represent that industry. One of the big reasons, actually, for inequality is because we have neglected the freedom, really, and the ability to thrive of labor unions. I'm from Detroit, from Michigan, and I know quite well how much good they did. Some of them could be abusive, but really, without unions, we'd be further behind.
One need only look at the immediate post-war era to find out the role unions played and subsequently the growth of the middle class at that time.
Yeah, big role. I was privileged to know Tony Sherwinski, who was the kind of the right-hand man of Reuther, one of them.
AFL-CIO, Walter Reuther.
And then UAW. Mm-hmm. They built that thing. You have to remember that people in the before they were unionized were making very, very little, almost nothing. So we've neglected that. And the result is that labor productivity has actually surged ahead, but wages have remained stagnant. There's been a disconnect between productivity and wages, and that's because the corporations have been able to pretty much do what they want. They simply can threaten unions. They can go. They can go to right-to-work states, or they can export jobs abroad. So they really have the they really have the domination there.
You mentioned earlier you thought healthcare was largely responsible for this inequity that we have been talking about. I'm going to bring in Tim calling from University City to bring up something that I would have pointed to as well. Tim, go ahead, but make it quick, please. Time's getting away.
Okay. Well, I'd like to make two quick comments. One is we've got to change the election funding process completely. And I would like to see something along this lines go grassroots and viral, maybe with initiative petitions among various states. If you can't vote, you can't contribute.
Yeah, we should actually have a law also that says that everybody automatically has the right to vote, as they do in Europe. We should be able to vote on a day which is declared a holiday, basically, so everybody can get to the polls. We should regard voting as a right, not as a privilege extended to us under certain circumstances. We need to organize how we're funding elections for sure. We should shorten the campaign season. All that simply benefits big money.
Yeah, I was surprised, and when you were talking about some of the influences, that you didn't mention Citizens United and that Supreme Court decision. I mean, it's huge.
It's beyond huge. As if big money needed any more advantages, but that really tips the scale. We need to essentially take all money out and make only public money available for the funding of elections. And until we do that, we're not going to be a real democracy.
Where do we go from here? We had about 2 minutes left. Where do we go from here in a realistic way?
Well, in a realistic way, it's very, very hard to say because we've had so many people who've gone in so many different directions trying to reform our political process, our economic process, the way we do health care. I think, as often happens, it's going to be one of those situations sort of bottom up. We're not getting the kind of leadership that we need or want from politicians. That doesn't mean that there aren't very good people out there. We just need more of them. I think we need for people, particularly progressive people, who have more or less sat back, I think, and not maybe had lost some of the confidence they used to have in progressive politics to come back and to make their voice heard. I've been very influenced by a historian, Tony Judt, who died prematurely, but he said that one of the obligations we have is to speak up and to say, talk about the things we really care about. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to come out and talk about all these issues today, actually.
Yeah, it's one thing to talk about it, but you have to pay to play in today's game. And, you know, the people who might want to do the talking can't afford to get into the game.
Yeah, they're excluded for the same reasons. They don't have access to the money, which is why we need, obviously, to reform the political process, but we can best do that, I think, by people coming out and having forums like this and coming to NPR, which is a really a great opportunity to meet the public. And we need to start meeting as publicly minded citizens in order to try to get back into the game.
What sort of early reaction have you had to your book and your thoughts on this?
Well, not a lot really so far. But when I talk to people about these issues, I find that everybody is very receptive to exactly these issues. But everybody's still sort of, well, where do we go from here? What do we do? And that's been the dilemma for some years. We have to cope with big money.
And that's kind of gotten us where we are today by people being reluctant to get in.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Professor Jack Lusko, thank you so much for being with us. The title of the book is The Great Forgetting.
Thank you.
It's an interesting read, and if you want to understand what's going on in our world and our society today, a lot of the explanation is right there in the book, The Great Forgetting, subtitled The Past, Present, and Future of Social Democracy and the Welfare State. Professor, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's it for today. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll hear another excerpt from the Where We Live Here podcast, focusing on the work of police officers. Then we'll talk with former policeman Terrell Carter and get his take on the racial divide in the region. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.